Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up, we're going to talk about what happened this past weekend and take some phone calls and talk with some of the organizers of the protest, too, as we go through this hour. We'll also hear Florida this week from this past Friday night. But first, two listener comments about last Friday's program. Last Friday, we were already talking about the community response to George Floyd's killing, both here and around the nation. And here's what two listeners had to say about last Friday's program.
This is Ron from West Tampa. Rob, on Friday, you asked the question, so where do we go from here? First, we as citizens must vote both locally and nationally for leaders who will bring forth the better angels of their nature and inspire us to bring the better angels of our nature out. One who will promote tolerance, respect, and dignity for all people. And not a president, for example, as President Trump does, that incites violence at his rallies and who has on numerous occasions castigated and disrespected Mexican Central Americans, saying that they bring drugs and crime, making us fear and distrust people of the Muslim faith, basically any other people that he, in his own dog whistle language, has inspired us to consider not worthy of America. We all have to do what we can, one small act at a time, one little thing at a time, with our neighbors, our friends, our relatives, our coworkers. And we have to rebuild our society and redirect it so it'll be one of civility and respect for all people. I mean, that's how we make the Constitution live up to its words, where all men are not just created equal, but treated as we want to be treated ourselves.
Yeah, this is Stephen from New Orleans. I'm a retired policeman. I was listening to your show, and the one thing that people can do to change what's going on in the world is to get involved. In particular, the younger people need to get into law enforcement and change it from within. And two more people are willing to do the job and try to change from within. Law enforcement's a difficult work. It's a blue-collar work, and a lot of people discourage their friends and relatives from doing it. And until you get people with the right attitude that are the people that really want to change things, get involved in it, then it's not going to change by magic. People have to do it. There's a lot of good people in it. Unfortunately, there's also people who do bad things, as in any profession. So the people that are most discouraged are the ones that should try to insist on relatives and friends to actually look at it as a form of work where they can you can change the world from within. I know in my years I've seen a lot of changes for the better. In particular, a lot more women got involved in law enforcement from when I came in. A lot of the women I first worked with actually had a suit to come on the job, and I saw a big difference in our department over the decades that I was there. And I think that as bad as people perceive things, things have gotten better and are improving. And if you want to improve it, to not discourage your relatives from doing it, because I know a lot of people tell their friends and families, don't dare get into that profession. Well, if you're discouraging the people that can change it from doing it, then who do you expect to do it?
Those two listener comments came in after Friday's program. We are going to talk about what happened over the weekend here in Tampa and in Sarasota and St. Petersburg and Lakeland. We'll hear one of the organizers of one of the marches that took place on Sunday. But first, we're going to hear Florida this week. And as we listen back to all of this, you can email your comments about whatever you hear to our email address, which is dj@wmnf.org. Coming up next, a federal judge rules that Florida cannot block felons from voting because they don't have money. The governor appoints two new justices to the state Supreme Court. Nursing homes are at the center of the COVID outbreak in Florida, and getting to the truth about the accuracy of Florida's COVID-19 statistics. All this and more on a special edition of Florida This Week. Welcome back. It's only been 3 months since the first case of COVID-19 was discovered here in Florida. Already, more than 50,000 people have been infected.
The number of confirmed cases in Florida has jumped by 20,000 since the beginning of this month, and the number of deaths has increased by more than 1,000. About half of the deaths in the state came from residents and staff at long-term care facilities such as nursing homes. Questions remain about how transparent the state is being about the overall number of cases. The impact of the COVID-19 shutdown is severe, with record levels of unemployment and state revenue in freefall, down by nearly $900 million in April alone. The sudden onset of the crisis is having a big impact, with the group of Floridians who, as a percentage, vote in the heaviest numbers, seniors. Donald Trump won that demographic by 17% 4 years ago. Now he trails Joe Biden among Florida's over 65 population. And this week, a federal judge issued a decision that could have an impact on the November election. In Tallahassee, Judge Robert Hinkle ruled that Florida cannot stop felons from voting because they can't afford to pay legal fees, court costs, or restitution. Hinkle called the law passed last year by the state legislature a pay-to-vote system. The judge's decision could have deep ramifications. Florida has an estimated 774,000 disenfranchised felons, representing a significant number of voters in a state well known for razor-thin election margins. A federal judge this week ruled that Florida cannot stop felons from voting if they're too poor to pay court fees, fines, or restitution. We're joined now by Lawrence Maurer. He's a reporter at the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald's Tallahassee Bureau, where he covers state government and politics. He joined the Bureau in 2018 from the Palm Beach Post, where he was on that paper's investigative team. Lawrence, nice to see you. Thank you for coming on Florida This Week.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
I want to ask you about the judge's decision. How significant is this if it is upheld? How many people would be affected? How major of a change is this?
Well, that's the big question. Well, the first one is, will it be upheld? If it is upheld, and this is something that is considered to be appealed, it'll probably be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. If it's upheld, it is a very big deal, not just for Florida, but for other states. You know, in Florida, we have at least 1 million felons who are likely ineligible to vote because they owe outstanding fines, fees, and restitution. We haven't really seen the massive number of people apply to register to vote from that group of people that a lot of people maybe were expecting. But nevertheless, this would be the greatest expansion of voting rights in the country, certainly over the last few decades.
Is the door open right now? Can people who are ex-felons who haven't been successful at the cabinet level getting their voting rights restored, can they just go down to the election supervisor's office now and sign up?
Yeah, they're working on that process. The judge created a form that people can use that basically allows them to file a petition with the Secretary of State asking for a kind of legal remedy, basically, to tell the state, hey, I can't afford to pay back these fines, fees, and restitution. And, you know, the Secretary of State has to come back and say, okay, well, they have to come back with a ruling within 21 days for this, saying, you know, here's how much you owe, here's how we calculated that. And if they don't do that within 21 days, neither the state nor the county elections supervisor can remove those people from the rolls. They have to be allowed to register. And it's, that's starting.
Has the governor said exactly what he plans to do, or has he been pretty quiet on whether or not he's going to appeal?
No, he said he will appeal. And that was expected. You know, early on, even when this was being debated in the legislature, lawmakers were expecting this to be an intense legal fight. The ACLU and other groups were not quiet about, hey, likely challenging what the legislature passed last year. And so this is something that's been expected. It was expected that they would lose in front of the judge in Tallahassee, Hinkle. It was expected to be appealed to the 11th Circuit. DeSantis hasn't done that, but he said he will. And from there, I mean, I think no matter how that goes, that will get appealed up to the Supreme Court.
I think there's been some reporting, some misunderstanding in some of the reporting I've read that suggests that
this judge's decision waives entirely the fines, fees, or restitution. What's the status of the fines, fees, and restitution that these people who served their sentences are supposed to pay?
So, yes and no to that. He did find that court fees, which are often, you know, like hundreds of dollars worth of fees that are tacked on to your sentence. He did say that those were unconstitutional. Those accounted for a tax, in effect. He called it a poll tax under any other name. Those are unconstitutional. He did not say, however, that people cannot be required to pay back restitution to victims or court fines. For example, like the $50,000 fine for drug trafficking, for example. Those are still required to be paid. And if you have the means to pay that, you need to pay that. The big question has been, how do you evaluate whether or not someone can afford to do that? And what he did is basically put that onus on the state and the county election supervisors by saying, you know, if you say you can't afford to do this, you can appeal to the state. It's on the state to come back and say, well, we do think you can. For example, they might have something showing you won the lottery, $50,000 in the lottery the last year or something like that. They could turn you down for that rejection.
Lawrence Maurer, thanks a lot for coming on Florida This Week. Great to see you.
Hey, great to see you too. Thanks for having me.
Pinellas County Commissioners voted unanimously this week to extend the local state of emergency until June 5th, but in a separate unanimous vote, they passed a resolution that lifts local restrictions on beaches, public swimming pools, and playgrounds. Ken Welch is the District 7 Commissioner in Pinellas County. He's also served as chair of the commission, as well as the Pinellas Suncoast Transit Authority and numerous other Pinellas County organizations. He joins us now from St. Petersburg. Commissioner Welch, great to see you. Thank you for coming on Florida This Week.
Great to be here, Rob. Thank you.
First of all, I want to start by asking about George Floyd's death. What are your thoughts about what's going on right now in Minneapolis?
Well, I think it's a reckoning. I think it's a culmination of a lot of despair in our nation. Not only George Floyd's death, but Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. But I think just the shocking nature of this video and actually watching a person who's obviously not a threat basically be murdered in front of your eyes, I think really has shocked the conscience of the nation. And certainly the kind of rioting and looting that we see is not what we prefer. I think in retrospect, what Colin Kaepernick was saying and trying to demonstrate simply by kneeling is much more preferable. But I think you're seeing that kind of frustration kind of come to fruition, and hopefully folks will move positively and cooler heads will prevail over the next couple of nights in Minneapolis.
Let's hope so. Yeah. I want to ask you about reopening the county. Do you think that the public understands at what stage we're at in terms of reopening the county?
Communication has been a real issue, whether it's from the national level or the state level. And exactly what's allowed and what's not. My fear is that folks think we're back to business as normal, and we really are not. The county is still recommending social distancing. We're still recommending that folks abide by CDC guidelines, that folks wear masks. All of those things are in our resolution. We are simply not requiring a mandatory social distancing or separation on the beaches. And that's from another number of perspectives. We are basically falling back to the state's reopening guidelines under phase one, and I anticipate we'll do the same thing with phase two and moving forward. But we still need folks to understand that there might be a second round, that folks are still transmitting the virus. We wanted to make sure that we flattened the curve, that we kept our hospital and ICU bed capacity, and we have done that. And that's why we are loosening up the restrictions slowly. But COVID-19 is still expanding throughout our nation and through our community, and folks need to be responsible.
How big of a hit to the county budget has this last 3 months been?
Well, the county's been very conservative in our budget over the years. We have a large reserve, over $100 million, and we have several funds. And so the funds that will be affected the most are, of course, our tourist development council funds funded by the bed tax. They've taken a big hit right at spring break, one of their heaviest times of the year in terms of revenue. So we'll have to make some adjustments there. And also our transportation trust fund. As you know, Rob, Hillsborough County passed a transportation tax a couple of years ago, and that was being challenged. There was a chance that they were going back to the ballot in November, and Pinellas County was certainly headed towards going to the ballot in November. And that would have been a transportation funding mechanism for the entire Tampa Bay region. We now don't have the opportunity to do that. And so I think in transportation, we'll have some challenges for the next couple of years.
Just a quick question. Do you anticipate any layoffs to county staff because of the budget situation?
I do not. After the last recession, Pinellas County government had several layoffs, and we've maintained an employee base at a 1988-1989 level since then. So we haven't staffed back up. So I think that will allow us not to have to go into layoffs in the near future.
Ken Welch, thanks for coming on Florida This Week. Great to see you.
Always a pleasure, Rob. Take care.
Take care. Thank you. Rosemary Gaudreau O'Hara is an award-winning journalist and a longtime observer of Florida politics. She grew up in Tampa and for many years was the editorial page editor at the Tampa Tribune. For the past 8 years, she's been the editorial page editor of the South Florida Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale, where she joins us today. Rosemary, great to see you again. Thanks for coming on Florida This Week.
Great to see you too, Rob.
So I want to ask you about Rebecca Jones. And let me just play a short clip from CNN the other night. She's the woman who says that she was told to fudge the data on the COVID-19 Florida Health Department website.
Now it's impossible to know how reliable that data is because they changed the way the data is calculated. They changed how they record the data and how they publish it. And data continues to go missing from the website when the dashboard now crashes all the time.
So, Rosemary, how is the public supposed to view this? We've heard from Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. She has questions about the health department data. Charlie Crist, the congressman from St. Petersburg, has said he has questions about how do we know what to believe? How do we get to the bottom of this?
Well, right now it's kind of a he said, she said. That's the state we're at. To know who's telling the truth, there really should be a hearing about it. Let there be a legislative hearing and take testimony and see, you know, what is the real truth here. It's such an important issue, and we deserve to know the truth. And the reason that the background is that the state government has been so withholding of data. You know, they didn't want the medical examiners giving out their death numbers for COVID because they were higher. They didn't want to give out numbers in nursing homes of deaths and who, for reasons that we don't really know. The state has not been real forthcoming. They've changed the dashboard a number of times. Personally, I had experience with Rebecca giving me access to information, which is an unusual thing for state government these days to be accessible. So let us clear the air. Let us have a hearing that the governor did not criticize or dispute what she said initially, but then came back and attacked her character. I thought was a little out of line. But I think we deserve a hearing to know what the real truth is here.
President Trump has said that he doesn't like the way North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina's mayor is opening up his city, and he may move the Republican convention out of North Carolina. And we've heard from Lenny Curry, the mayor of Jacksonville. He says, sure, bring it to Jacksonville. The mayors of Tampa and St. Petersburg have said no, but is it realistic to think that Florida might host the Republican convention?
You know, this is only in August, 3 months away. The scientists say that mass gatherings should be the last to come back. If Florida truly is on a safe, steady phase in of recovery, why would we be talking about having a mass gathering where people are, you know, sitting close together and yelling for and shouting and cheering for their candidate. It is not the time to until we know that it's safe. Why would we want to expose so many people, especially in like in South Florida? I mean, they've talked about South Florida too. So there's just so much that goes into it. There's a lot of money that people in North Carolina have put forward to host this convention. They're not going to want their money to go to Florida. It takes time to arrange for the blocks of hotel rooms and transportation. It takes in security. It kind of feels like when the Tampa Bay Rays were threatening to move and they were kind of holding the city hostage to pay for a new ballpark. I think that's what the president is doing with Charlotte.
One other big story I want to ask you about, and that is the governor this week was able to appoint two new members of the Florida Supreme Court. One is an immigrant from Jamaica. The other is the son of people who fled Cuba. His dad was part of the Pedro Pan escape from Cuba. They're both members of the Federalist Society. What do you make of the governor's appointments to the Florida Supreme Court?
Well, their appointment certainly brings diversity of ethnicity and gender to the Supreme Court, but it does not bring diversity of ideology, diversity of thought. You know, in Florida, the governor appoints all members of the Supreme Court. The state Senate has nothing to do with who gets appointed. The only requirement is that the governor has to choose somebody whose name has been forwarded by the Florida Supreme Court Judicial Nominating Committee. Now think about this. All members of the JNC are members of the Federalist Society. The governor is a member of the Federalist Society. The former governor was a member of the Federalist Society. The two jurists that these two appointees will replace, who had been appointed by Governor DeSantis and then were tapped by President Trump for the appeals court, they were members of the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is associated with a philosophy that is conservative, libertarian, less government regulation, interpret the Constitution as it was written in 1787. And everybody, it's become these JNCs and the bench has become like this political patronage society. You know, Judge Renetha Francis has only been a judge for 3 years. Judge Curiel has never been a judge. So were they the best we could do? I think the jury's out on that.
Rosemary Gaudreau, always great to see you. Thank you for coming on. I can't wait to see you again.
Good to see you too, Rob. Thanks so much. Hi, Tampa.
Brian Lee is a renowned elder advocacy expert who leads the National Nursing Home Watchdog Group, Families for Better Care. And he joins us now. Brian, nice to see you. Thank you for coming on Florida This Week.
Rob, it's good to see you. Thank you for the invitation, and I look forward to our conversation.
I want to ask you about these numbers regarding nursing home deaths. About 50% of all the deaths from COVID-19 here in Florida have come in nursing homes or assisted living facilities. Yet, that's only 2% of our population. So what do you make of those numbers?
It just goes to show what we've been seeing across the country is that this virus has had a staggering effect on those who live in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. In fact, just over the last 2 weeks, we went back and looked at the numbers, and we found that there's been a 25% increase in the number of long-term care facilities that have had a COVID-related death, and the number of residents who have died in facilities in those last 2 weeks has increased by 60%. So it just goes to show that this virus is not contained. It's still deadly. It's proving to be fatal for far too many residents. And I think that those numbers are going to continue to climb as we get better testing, better results happening within facilities. And to some it could be argued that to some degree that the data collection has been a little better by the state and the publication of the data has been a little better. But there's one fact we know is that this virus is proving to be deadly. I mean, there's like an Exocet missile on the back of residents who live in these nursing homes. They have comorbidities, underlying healthcare conditions. If this virus gets into these homes, it could prove to be very deadly, very fast, and can ravage facilities pretty quickly.
Is the state of Florida doing all it can to stop the spread or try to prevent the spread of this virus in nursing homes, whether it's the residents of those homes or the staff? Is it doing enough?
I think the state of Florida has actually been ahead of the rest of the country when it comes to its response in these facilities. I got to give Governor DeSantis some credit to some things that he has done. I think the transparency took a little bit of time early on. I think that the information was slow to get out to consumers, a little bit sluggish, but the state is actually now publishing much more information about outbreaks that are happening, the deaths that are occurring. They're two separate lists right now. It's a little bit difficult to navigate sometimes. So I think that if the state would reconcile those lists and marry those two lists together, I think it'd be a little bit more beneficial. But I think that where Governor DeSantis and the state of Florida have actually been, again, ahead of the rest of the country is the fact that they've been in facilities testing a little bit more on a more frequent basis. Governor DeSantis was out there early on sending strike teams to different facilities with epidemiologists and trying to provide guidance and assistance to facilities and trying to get a handle on potential outbreaks. And then from there, he has worked in tracing surveillance of the COVID outbreaks in facilities, all the way from that, just the strike teams, but also the National Guard. And now that there's an RV that's kind of hopscotching across the state doing testing right now in as many facilities as it can get to. But even with all those measures that have been put in place, it's still the testing is what's critical. It's what's going to actually prevent the spread in facilities. But it's still woefully inadequate in Florida, even with all of the tracing that's happening and all these measures that have been in place. We believe that's not good enough. We think that there should be universal testing of residents and staff happening on a regular basis, and that could happen through through using rapid testing machines. We know there's technology out there that can deliver results within minutes, and if facilities had these in place in their buildings, they could test residents frequently. They could test the staff frequently. Here's why that's important is because if a staff person gets tested and the residents get tested, the Department of Health comes out, does that testing, and then they walk out the front door 5 minutes later, a caregiver goes to Costco on behalf of the facility to go purchase toilet paper. They come back to the facility, but while they're at Costco waiting in line, someone didn't have a mask on. They coughed all over them. They picked up the COVID-19 and then they brought it back to the nursing home. Unbeknownst to them, they're a COVID carrier. They're exposing all the residents. So this is why it's critically important that these machines be in place in the buildings so they can almost become like their own testing centers for residents and staff. And if they were, here's even an added advantage if these machines were there, that families could go visit their residents. They could be tested before they enter into the building. They could wait for the results to come back within minutes. And if it's a negative, they could go see their loved one. They could go and hug their spouse. They can go and help with any kind of care needs that they may need. Right now, that's not happening. And for what we have seen and we've heard, Governor DeSantis has said that at least, I think it's July 7th is when potentially he will revisit the possibility of families going back to nursing homes. But I think that that's still... that's probably going to be too early, and he'll probably reevaluate that and maybe get back some more. And so that's not good for residents and families.
Brian, we only have 30 seconds left, but by the governor's own figures, as reported by the Palm Beach Post, only about 10% of nursing home residents and staff have been tested so far. Does the governor have the power or who has the power to get these rapid testing machines in nursing homes?
Yeah, here's the beauty of this. We could pay for those testing machines right now. It wouldn't cost taxpayers a dime. There are nursing home fines that the state of Florida is sitting on. We believe there's about $31 million in fines that are available to purchase rapid testing machines. The governor could pick up the phone and call President Trump and ask if President Trump could open ask the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service to unlock those funds to be used for that effort. I mean, we could do that overnight. And again, free to taxpayers, testing machines in every building, families could be reunited, nursing homes could be healed.
Brian Lee, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night, and my guests were Brian Lee with the nursing home watchdog group Families for Better Care. Ken Welch, the Pinellas County Commissioner, was on that show. Rosemary Goodrow, the editorial page editor of the South Florida Sun Sentinel newspaper, and Lawrence Maurer with the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald newsroom up in Tallahassee. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can email us in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. We're going to hear from one of the organizers of Sunday's protest in Tampa, around the Bay Area in Tampa and St. Petersburg, Lakeland, and Sarasota. There were protests this past weekend, multiple protests. Thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people took part. There were several arrests, at least 40 arrests in Tampa on Saturday. There was about 14 arrests in St. Petersburg last night. And also, according to media reports, there was a series of arrests in Hillsborough County outside of Tampa, at least seven arrests in Hillsborough County on Saturday evening after the protests. Most of the protests were peaceful, but there was some burning and looting, especially late Saturday night. And we're going to hear, as I mentioned before, one of the organizers of Sunday's protests in just a moment. But first, WMNF volunteer Blanny Whalen met with several of the protesters over the weekend and asked them why they were joining the protests, and this is what they had to say.
Okay, live? All right. Well, my name is Juan. I joined the march today, namely to help speak out for my friends and members of the community who are being affected by all this. I cannot abide letting violence like this and letting this senseless systemic racism continue. One thing that I wholeheartedly believe in is the greatest evil is indifference, and I refuse to be indifferent to this. I refuse to not stand up and say that this is wrong, that this is a problem. We have to take action. We can't allow this senselessness to continue. We need every ally. We need everyone to speak up against this. We have people from all over the world speaking up about this right now, because this has been going on for far too long, and enough is enough. You know, like, how many more lives? How many more dead bodies? How many more innocent people have to die at the hands of an institution that we have provided it as part of a social contract, the authority to serve and protect us, and they abuse that authority. They abuse that to an unconscionable degree. It's not necessary. We have to make a change.
News with Wayne Orr. And Wayne, you're at the demonstration today. Tell me why you're here.
We're here because we want equal rights. This world, this country is still being ran on laws that was put into effect probably after World War II with no input from any woman of color or any other man besides black and brown, just nine white men and rich, powerful white men, may I add to that. And their rules that they put into effect after World War II is still into effect to this day and has had no input from a woman at all. For any woman of any color, white, black, brown, none of them, and four or less men, we built most of this country. So half of this country should be ours rightfully. So we should have equal rights. There's no reason why white people should be so much wealthier than the black people. And they was blessed with so much more than we was. It wasn't like that. It was because we was manipulated out of our things when we didn't know any better. Our ancestors was manipulated out of their property, out of their businesses, because they didn't know any better, and they was being boycotted. So it's very deep, and it goes back very far, and the rules need to change. Until these rules change and until they understand what's really going on, this is what we're going to do, and it's going to stay like this.
You're out here with your two children, and what do you say to your children?
This is for their future. So they can know what they're into, the world they're growing up in and the world that they live in. I want them to know how they look at them. My kids, my wife, she's Mexican and Italian. My kids is mixed with Mexican and Italian. I'm all black. But when they look at my kids, all they're going to see is black.
and that's not right.
Thank you so much. Hi, this is WMNF News, and I'm here with Kristen Orr. Yes, I'm here just to show support to my fellow Black family and community. What they're doing is wrong. I know everyone feels the emotion, the pain, the hurt. I'm holding a sign that says no mother should fear if her child will return home. And that speaks so much volume. No mother should bury their child. A child should bury their mother.
We're here live with Tanisha. I'm out here in Temple with Black Lives Matter. I mean, there is some good cops out here and there are some bad cops out here. The situation that we're trying to pull and get forward to is all lives matter. No justice, no peace.
Hi, this is Blaney Whelan for WMNF News, and I'm here with
Marissa.
And Marissa, why do you feel it's important to be here today?
Because the system needs change. We need change, particularly in law enforcement. There's a lot of things like qualified immunity. If we can't change the laws that allow these law enforcement officers free rein to do whatever they want, things aren't going to change. As long as they know they can't be held accountable in a court of law, that has to change. Internal affairs has to change. You can't have the police policing the police. We need independent independent parties reviewing police brutality and claims of police brutality. And there needs to be a lot more training in de-escalation and diversity. That's my opinion.
Thank you. Marissa, who yesterday was also at the demonstration for Mr. Floyd, and she has she stayed with the demonstration till past 6 o'clock, as well as her children. And tell me a little bit what happened after that.
I know the demonstration started at Fowler and 56th Street, and from there we proceeded to March. I got about halfway, but I know my daughter and my niece continued with the marchers all the way to Bruce B. Downs and Fowler. And at that point, you know, they protested there for a little bit and turned back, came back. When they returned and met up with me near 50th and Fowler, there was, you know, a fairly large group of people. We returned all the way back to 56th Street, and there was no incident. I don't believe that what occurred on Bush, the incident that occurred on Bush Boulevard, had anything to do with the protest on Fowler Avenue at all. Neither did the University Mall, the incidents at the mall. I don't believe that those were related in any way to the protest on Fowler.
Thank you.
Some of the people demonstrating over the weekend in Tampa over the killing of George Floyd and over police abuse of Black Americans. Blaney Whalen gathered those interviews. And now we're going to hear from one of the organizers of yesterday's rally in Tampa. It took place yesterday afternoon. She is Shakira Parker with the African American Muslim Alliance, and I spoke with her earlier today. Shakira Parker, thanks for coming on WMNF. Let me ask you, you were one of the organizers of the protests over the weekend. Here it is Monday morning. What's your take on what happened?
Well, I am still extremely proud of the organizers. It was a labor of love for us to do this as a gift to the city of Tampa, to allow those who needed to express their frustration and their anger and their outrage in a controlled environment to do so. Having looked at the events of the weekend, the protest did just that. It was peaceful. It was wonderful. Thousands came out. Families came out. After the protest, there were a few agitators, I think, that, you know, tried to antagonize the police officers. And that's when, after the event had already ended, that's what uprooted that. But in looking at the events over the weekend in totality, you know, what I see is civil unrest. What I see is a pressure cooker that is having a little bit of air coming out, and it's coming out in an explosion. That's what I see when I see the unrest that's happening and the looting.
How many groups are involved in organizing protests in Tampa? And talk about the range of people that you saw there at the demonstration.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad that you asked me that. That was one of the most important matters, that how many organizations came together. There are about 13 organizations that came from across the state of Florida. These are some of the top civil rights organizations within Florida. And for everybody to pull this together within 48 hours was really simply incredible. You had organizations like Black Lives Matter, Dream Defenders, CARE, the African American Muslim Alliance. You had Lifestyle Network, Pastor Darren Jones, and he led 25 clergy and of all faith denominations. The Surly Feminist was there, MULAC, Stop the Violence, Tampa Bay, Organized Florida, Democrat Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay, Circle of Mothers, Standing Up for Racial Justice, Tampa, have all answered the call. And I think at one of the last moments, the Rainbow Push Coalition that was founded by Reverend Jesse Jackson, they also attended. So just quite incredible show of support for the community.
Was there a demand that united all these groups? Was there something that all these groups hope will happen in the city of Tampa now that this protest is taking place?
Well, yes, absolutely. Stopping the violence against Black people and Black lives. I mean, that is one of the major push that everyone is wanting. We need a citizens' oversight for the police department. We've collectively been trying to push for this for several years. We want to make sure that there's sensitivity training so that fatality is not the end of any type of arrest. This has to make sure that the police understand that there are systemic issues, systemic racism within certain infrastructures, and we want to make sure that there's sensitivity training and that we're changing the culture so that everyone can leave at the end of the day once this is over.
Shakira, you talked about agitators and the action that took place after the official demonstration was over. I was watching a little bit of video on Channel 28, and there were two white, for lack of a better term, white nationalists chanting alongside a reporter at Channel 28, chanting white nationalist slogans. It appears that these guys infiltrated part of the demonstration on Saturday. Have you heard about this, and what do you make of it?
I have, and I noticed one of the unique things that our organizations did is that we had safety marshals, and we had them trained prior. So one of the things, part of the training, is that we were able to identify agitators, and there were a group, I'd say, of 20, and they were dispersed in like maybe units of five, and they, after things were done and moved aside, they then came back to try to agitate the police. And then, of course, when you have a crowd and you see, you know, with that energy, then people are going to join along, and then that's when the police, you know, moved in with SWAT gear and then started shooting rubber bullets.
Was anybody injured?
There were a few people injured. As we were going back to, we were running back, you know, to a safe place. There was a man that we were able to help. He had rubber bullets. He was pepper sprayed, and he had also received some of the gas as well. And so we were trying to pour milk over him. He almost had to get down to his bare's minimum because his whole body was burning, and especially in his areas, he was not doing well at all. Several people were affected.
And do we know what's happened to this man?
He was taken home. One of the reasons why it was important for the organizations that I mentioned to put this together is because we have the experience. We're veteran organizers, and so we knew how to, you know, make sure that we could hold this in an area to make sure that the rest of the community was safe. So there were other
I think, protests that were happening throughout the city. We went there, too, to make sure that, you know, the kids or they were protected and that we could, you know, help them out. We also had legal observers that were with us at our march. And so we were able to try to at least give some support, some experienced support to those protesters in other areas.
We're talking with Shakira Parker, who is one of the organizers of the Stop Killing Us, the March for Black Lives over the weekend in Tampa. And so, Shakira, what's next?
Well, we definitely, one of the best ways that you can mobilize people is to show unity and solidarity, especially in the light of these most recent fatal shootings. We're demanding that Black Lives Matter. We're looking at the police brutality. It's not an isolated incident. We are asking that moving next, we are going to be putting out voter cards, doing research, interviewing these candidates. We've had a lot of sign-up sheets and a lot of interest so that we can be able to reach back to those individuals who want to be able to help and move the pendulum forward for justice. So we'll be having other forums, we'll be having other things, and we'll be communicating to try to make sure that we can reach that goal of having a citizens' oversight, a citizens' oversight committee for the Department of Police in Tampa, and then also Hillsborough County for the sheriff. So we want to make sure that law enforcement, that the citizens, you know, take their voice and their concerns, and that it is heard. There's also, I think there's a recent article, there's no body cams. That's something also that we're pushing for as well. We want to make sure that we have transparency and that these initiatives are understood by the administrations, and that we can secure this to try to hopefully reduce the police violence that happens.
Shakira, just so I have my notes right, too, you helped organize the event on Sunday at Cyrus Green. Did you also help organize Saturday's event?
No.
No. Okay.
No. It was just on Sunday.
Is there anything else that I should have asked you that you'd like to tell us about the protests on Sunday?
I'm very proud of all of the support that we received from the community. Some of the officials, they came out as well. We do appreciate that. We appreciate the trust that the community had in us to know that we were going to be able to provide them an environment in which they could express themselves. Because I mean, we saw the things that happened on Saturday. So we were concerned that people were going to be afraid to come out. And so we really just want to thank the community for entrusting us in coming out.
Shakira Parker, thanks a lot. And thank you for coming on WMNF.
All right. Thank you so much for having us.
That was one of the organizers of yesterday's rally in East Tampa on Martin Luther King and 22nd Street, Shakira Parker with the African American Muslim Alliance. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. She spoke there about outside agitators at the rallies over the weekend. And there's an interesting article on Creative Loafing's website. And I'll just play a little bit of sound from what they linked to. This is where two white guys dressed in Hawaiian shirts, apparently part of the Boogaloo movement, and if you're a regular listener to this program, we've been talking about white racists hoping to start a race war. They call it a Boogaloo. Two men chanting what appears to be a white racist slogan, chanting Groiper. And let me just read from the Creative Loafing article. According to the Anti-Defamation League, Groipers are considered a white supremacist group, though they are sometimes called Christian conservatives who oppose things like immigration and globalism and gay and transgender rights and feminism. Let's listen to a little bit. This was caught on tape as a WFTS TV reporter was standing at one of the protests over the weekend, and these two white guys kind of invaded the camera space and started chanting.
Out right now, just trying to get their message out as well.
Put
my mask up. So this is what we've been having going around here. I mean, when you think about what's been going on, it's just that these folks
so
are
that's
coming
a out. Couple of white guys chanting Groiper, which is a slogan of white supremacists. And that was in Tampa, captured over the weekend. You can find that video on the Creative Loafing website. Let's open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. There are a lot of emails that have come in. I'll try to read some. But before we do that, let's go to take some phone calls from listeners. And we're going to go to D in Tampa. D, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Am I on the line?
Yeah, you're live, D. What would you like to say?
Okay, you know what? You know what? I was Saturday, I didn't even know this was going on. I was with a friend in Ybor City. We just had a lunch at one of the local restaurants in Ybor City on 7th Avenue. And to come home and to find out what was going on was just like, I don't even know how to describe my words. We've kind of gone through this before. Come on, Rob. We know about this happening years ago.
Well, yeah. In fact, I've been in touch with some of the people that went through this in 1967, 68 in Tampa, and I'm going to try to bring them on in a few days because this
is. I've been through this in Brooklyn. I'm coming from New York. You know, I'm a native of New York, of Brooklyn, New York, and I remember back in the Eleanor Bumper and all of that kind of protest. So this is kind of it was kind of surreal. For me, I can understand the protest. I don't understand, and I know I'm going to get some backlash from this. I don't understand, because I live in that community. I lived in there for years. The destruction of businesses. If you're going to be mad at something, be mad at the point. You've been mad at the cops. Businesses did not have nothing to do with somebody putting a chokehold on that man's neck. That wasn't a business. So why, and I'm having a problem with, why would you want to, places that I shop at, that I go to, that now I can no longer shop at? You know, it was so sad to me because there was black businesses involved in this whole destruction too. I understand protest and loitering is two different situations.
Yeah, and okay. Several of the businesses that were burned down are owned by people of color. The gas station, the shoe store in Tampa, the Asian restaurant.
This is a problem. I'm like, I stop at all these, and I have children in that area. You know what was so sad to me that I had to call. I didn't know what was going on because I didn't get home from Ybor City till late. But I'm having to call my children up. I have a black American son. So I'm having to call him, where you at? Please stay home.
Yeah, and Dee, I had to talk to my daughter in Brooklyn, too, because I wanted to make sure she was safe. Dee, thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank
you're
you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And let's go to Scott in St. Petersburg. Scott, what would you like to say?
Hey there, Rob. First off, I just want to say they closed down Tyrone Mall. I was out in that area, and everything's shutting down. So I guess they might have had some problems there last night and maybe expecting something today.
Yeah, they closed a lot of malls because every mall near one of these protests was in fear. I don't know if that's justified, right. But yeah, they did. And they closed down the drugstores that were in the vicinity of the protests. Yeah.
You know, it's the same because, like my waiter, I was able to get a little food before they made their decision. Like he goes, I'm a single father, I've got kids, you know, and I can't make any money. I got to pay rent. I mean, I understand why they're having the riots, you know, and I think the point has been made, but, you know, you're hurting other people and it's looking worse in the eyes of people that, you know, are against this. I just think, you know, people got to sit down and take a breath and say, let's just stay home and see what happens.
All right, Scott, thanks a lot. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and there were a lot of emails that people wanted to send in. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up on my comment line, which is 813-238-8001, and record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for Sean Canaan. He's going to devote his whole hour to the protests over the weekend here in the Tampa Bay area, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland, and we're going to get the latest news right now from NPR.